Look to this day. For it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of your existence. The bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day.
Good morning. Look to this day. And now shall we join together in some moments of prayer and reflection. Morning has come. We are glad to be here as guests of this congregation. Though we meet bringing with us many thoughts, concerns, and hopes, let us find space here for quietness of mind and spirit. Let us find space for gentle breaths, the gentle rhythm of our in-breath and our out-breath. Let us gather together the fragmented bits of ourselves and be wholly present. Let us be reconnected with who we are and that divine ground of all being. We are creatures of light and darkness. Even in the midst of deepest concerns, our lives are shot through with lifted moments. We laugh, we sing, we praise, we have moments of astonishment, moments of delight. Spirit of life and love, help us to cherish these moments. Help us to live our lives ever open to moments of joy. In times of weakness and confusion, may we yet discover the power of renewal. In times of sorrow, may we yet feel connection with all that is. In our joy, may we share the strength which flows through us with others. And in so many moments of our lives, may we come to sense more fully the power and the glory and the mystery in which we live. Amen. It's lovely just to breathe deeply in this place on this beautiful morning. Well, our story this morning, it's quite a short story actually, and it's about a saint and stained glass. Hence your picture. And I just must tell you something about this picture, because it's lovely. You can see the backs of one or two people you know, I think. And it was our gathering, our last panel meeting gathering, when we were trying to get together all the minutiae of this week, and we needed to be together for some while to do that. And we were in the New Forest when we were doing this, and... thank you, Alison, for correcting me. Oh, you can tell I'm a northerner. The Forest of Dean, yes. We had some trouble finding it, actually, where we were staying. Quite a bit of trouble. But anyway, we did, in the end, and we found this lovely place to be together for that few days. It was splendid. And then, this exceptional sort of gift, really, there was a sculpture trail very close to where we were staying. And if you've been to that part of the world, you may recognize this stained glass. Beautiful. Hoisted on the trees. Right at the start of the sculpture trail. Just absolutely magnificent. So that was why you got that picture then. And this story is just called The Making of a Saint, and it's about a little boy who's out shopping with his mother, and she goes off into the supermarket, and she's busy, and he's just left wondering, you know, what to do, and it just so happens there's a cathedral nearby, and he looks up at the windows, he's looking at the outside of the building, and he notices they look pretty dirty, grimy, not really very spectacular at all, and he's a bit disappointed, because he expects bit more of this. And when his mother returns from her shopping, he says, don't think much of those windows, what's special about this place? And she says, well, come on, let's just go inside. So she takes him inside, and they stand in front of a stained glass window. And he notices the light's coming through, the sun's coming through, and it's making shapes on the stone floor of the cathedral, and he's entranced by the colours and the magic of it. And he notices an image, a sort of picture dancing, as it were, on the stone flags. And he points at this, and he says to his mother, well, what's that? What's that? And she says, well, just look up there, that stained glass window. Just look up there, and there's a picture of a saint there. And when the light shines through her, it makes these lovely patterns on the stone floor. You thought those windows were pretty grimy and not very attractive, but just look at all this wonderful colour and remember. So he remembers, he stores it up in his mind, and some time later he goes to school, and they're in the middle of a religious education lesson, and the teacher asks, does anyone know what makes a saint? And he shoots his hand up. He says, a saint is someone the light shines through, and when that happens, it makes the stones come to life. Now I'm going to read from Nancy Crumwine's book, Humility, Anger and Grace. And I'm reading from the last chapter. And this last chapter is called In Which Grace Is. Time is the heartbeat of existence. This moment here when grace breaks through the meaninglessness of objects in space. Meaning breaks through our busyness and stops us in our tracks. With a simple turning, we are met with divinity. The strength of the prophetic tradition is precisely this. the sanctification of time, this audacious theological claim that the divine enters history, that assistance comes into human life through the reality of time itself, and that we can participate in eternity through an entrance into this very time we so dread. Our culture has corrupted this insight again and again, but it is still a theological truth worth striving for. The infinite dwells in the finite. The moments of this world are worthy of love, worthy of our attachment and devotion, because it is through those moments we enter into the divine. It is through this abundance, unmerited by even our best moments, that we discover the holiness in time, which is grace.
Stand up resurrected in the middle of the day, with our living hair and our breathing skin. Nothing unusual around us, no mirage of palms with grazing lions and gentle wolves. The alarm clocks do not stop ticking. Their illuminated hands do not go dark. And yet, insubstantial and safe from all wounds, drawn up in secret order, we are carried forward to a house of light.
There's a story based on a Swedish legend where on a lovely summer's day at noon in the forest, the birds have tucked their heads under their wings. And in the midst of deep stillness, the bullfinch pops his head up and asks the most profound question: what is life? And a rose that's just emerging from bud and opening up petal by petal, enjoying this newly discovered sunlight, replies, life is becoming. And the butterfly just blithely flying from one flower to another, sort of sucking from everything, sucking delicious nectar from everything, and much less philosophical, and says, life is pure pleasure and sunshine. But down below on the ground, there's an ant laboring under a piece of straw that's 10 times his weight, and remarks, life is nothing but toil, sweat, and strain. And so this discussion about the meaning of life continues as the day moves from noon to night and towards the end of the day. A magnificent eagle swoops high above the forest, calls life a constant striving upwards. Night falls, and there's a young man staggering home from a party, and he's complaining that life is just a constant search for happiness and just a string of disappointments. And then, after the long dark night, at last dawn comes, rising pink on the eastern skyline, just as I, the dawn, am the start of the new day, so life is the beginning of eternity. Daybreak. The dawn has come. And when I think of that, I'm reminded of the beginning of probably one of the most famous plays in the English language, Hamlet. I'm reminded of the edginess of that, at the beginning of that play, where it's the middle of the night, and it's very shivery, and there are Danish soldiers on guard, because Norway is, they've sort of got into skirmishes with their neighbours, the Norwegian neighbours. And it's bitter cold, and it's such a sort of dark, edgy kind of feeling. And they're disturbed, in the midst of this, they're disturbed by the ghost of Hamlet's father coming sort of across the battlements. And then, after a long period of time, dawn breaks, the cock crows, and Horatio says, "But look, the dawn in russet mantle clad walks o'er the dew of yon high eastward hill." And suddenly all that nightmare it's disappeared. The words themselves are so much more than a description of just the first signs of daylight. The words create the space when light and grace can enter in the midst of darkness. Shakespeare knew what he was doing. And that first hymn, I think, does the same. The morning hangs a signal upon the mountain crest, while all the sleeping valleys in silent darkness rest. From peak to peak it flashes, it laughs along the sky, till glory of the sunlight on all the land doth lie. Places where grace can enter. Now that word grace is a theological word that most people feel comfortable with, unlike many other theological words, it has to be said. My impression is that most of us have very positive associations with this word grace. And I think that's the case whether we define ourselves as Christian, theist, or firmly agnostic or humanist. Wherever we are on this religious spectrum, grace is okay. So it should be. Theologically speaking, grace is a divine attribute, the most powerful of divine attributes. John's Gospel spells it out in a particular way. "And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth." In the strictest possible Christian sense, grace is the embodiment of God the Father in the gift of his Son, Jesus. In the Hebrew Bible, grace is the gift of loving care given to God's people through their covenant with him. Most of us have some feeling for the word grace and are not hindered by strict interpretations, whether we're Christians or non-Christian. Grace is a word with enormous resonance. But above all, I think most of us regard it as an unexpected gift and feel such gratitude when it enters our lives. At its heart, it is gratia from the Latin, kindness shown to another, a gift for which one gives thanks. One writer describes it in this way: "Grace is the light or electricity or juice or breeze that takes you from that isolated place and puts you with others who are as startled or embarrassed and eventually grateful as you are to be there." For me, one of the most moving uses of this concept of grace came when I read Richard Holloway's book on forgiveness. Richard Holloway was Bishop of Edinburgh for, I think, 14 years or so in the Church of Scotland. And in his final chapter, he writes about Nelson Mandela, and he refers to Mandela's forgiveness as the insanity of grace. Isn't that just... And this is what he says. I once stood outside the cell that Nelson Mandela had occupied on Robben Island and saw the thin mat on the cold floor in which he'd slept for 18 years and was choked by the enormity of his graciousness. Those are the conditions that normally produce enraged avengers whose actions we deplore, yet whose embittered logic we can understand. The enormity of forgiveness flowing from such conditions is impossible to understand. It is the insanity of grace. We call this absolutely gratuitous conduct grace or gift, because it comes upon us, if it comes at all, without condition. It is done for its own sake, out of the pure joy and love of doing it. Grace breaks through time and busyness. Always it has the ability to astonish and amaze. In his Four Quartets, T.S. Eliot refers to it as the moment in the rose garden, the moment in and out of time, the distraction fit lost in a shaft of sunlight, the wild time unseen, or the winter lightning, or the waterfall, or music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all, but you are the music while the music lasts. I think we can only understand the quality of grace in a poetic way. Even theologically, it is a form of poetry. How else can we begin to understand what is meant by this God-given outpouring of love? Love flows from God to man without effort, as a bird glides through the air. Words of Mechtilde of Magdeburg. There are many places where grace can enter. When something comes as an unexpected gift and deepens our lives, there are many dawns when darkness is put to flight. Each of you will have moments when grace has entered unbidden. Moments of clarity, moments of deep thankfulness, moments that feel like a blessing, moments that are more than just moments of happiness, moments that feel like a fountain springing from a rock wall, and even moments that feel like the breath of God. I'm going to finish with one famous American poet's words, some of you will be very familiar with, about grace. Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Amen.
For the earth we give thanks. May we respect it, enjoy it, and hand it on unspoiled.
For living beings we give thanks.
May we reverence them, wonder at them, and share the world with them as best we can.
For children we give thanks.
May we love them, guide them, and let them go when the time comes.
For us we give thanks.
May we suffer them, forgive them, and try to do better ourselves.
For ourselves we give thanks.
May we know ourselves, confront ourselves, and learn to know that we are always worthy of love.
For God we give thanks.
Whoever, whatever, he, she, or it may be. Without God there would be nothing to give thanks for. Nothing to give thanks. We can live, we can love, we can celebrate this miracle of which we are part.
We give thanks to the divine creative spirit.